for the nice introduction. So title of my talk is long. Can you actually hear me? Does the mic work? Okay, very good. So and this is based on joint work, so several papers with these co-authors. And so let me start by giving you two motivations for doing the things that appear in these papers, because these are somewhat complicated things, and so you might not like the theorems when you look at them, and so they need a lot of motivation. Okay, so here's motivation number one. So that's integer programming, so that's the area that I was trained in. So integer programming, of course, studies variants of linear programs that are much harder, right? So instead of just looking at linear functionals to be maximized over polyhedra, we now have these nasty integrality constraints and all the variables that just make life so much harder. And so in between these two classes is somehow a compromise. So that's what we call mixed integer programs. And so in its linear incarnation, it's means we are maximizing some linear functional over, well, these red slices here. So that means we are looking at these points that have integer coordinates in some of these in some prescribed coordinates, but they can be arbitrary real numbers everywhere else. And so one might think that somehow these mixed integer programs should be easier to solve because, well, only some of the variables are constrained to be integers. Well, it's not exactly true, but you're getting quite a lot of more complicated geometry here. So instead of having just integer points in polytopes or polyhedra, you're now getting these polyhedral slices. So you get families of these polyhedral slices. And so the geometry is more complicated, makes algorithms more complicated. Okay, so that's motivation number one. And so we have some easy and some hard problems here. And we actually don't want to talk about the purely linear case here, or not really about the purely linear integer case, but rather we're interested in slightly nonlinear variants here. So let's consider this problem here, where all the nonlinearity is actually hidden in the objective function. So we are now maximizing or minimizing some function f, and so for the purpose of this talk, this will be a polynomial function, so in several variables, but it's still subject to linear constraints. And we could write it like this, so x1 to xd are maybe lying in a polytope intersected with z to the d. Okay, and I need to emphasize that we are interested here in general polynomial functions, so we do not assume anything about convexity here. So when things are convex and we are minimizing, then things become very easy, and so, rather easy, because they're closer to the linear case. So these famous old results by Lenstra, such that branching on hyperplanes, if done right, gives a polynomial time algorithm, can be extended to these convex cases as well. So here's a citation where this worked out for convex polynomials in a rather complicated setting. But when we don't have this kind of convexity, then these problems become really, really hard. Not even having fixed dimension or low dimension saves us. So simply when we introduce nonlinearity, then there are difficult arithmetic problems that already show their nasty heads when the dimension is small. So you can see here, it's already an NP-hard problem if you want to maximize some arbitrary degree 4 polynomial over just two variables and linear constraints. And so here's just a little example that illustrates why this is a very expressive problem class and why we should expect some hardness. So the example I'll show you does not show the hardness, but almost. Okay, it convinces us. So let's consider the problem of factoring an integer. So given an integer n in n, do there exist x and y, natural numbers, I guess, x, y greater or equal to 2, such that x times y is equal to n. And so if so, find them. So that's a problem of factoring, and so we'll consider this problem and cast it in the form of a polynomial integer optimization problem. And so, well, how do we do this? Well, we obviously use these two variables here. And then, well, so this is a nonlinear constraint here, so we want to avoid it. It doesn't fit into the framework. So let's just look at the difference n minus x times y. Let's square it. So that's a degree 4 polynomial in two variables. And so if we minimize this, and we can solve this optimization problem, then we can obviously factor. Now, nobody knows how hard factoring is. And so this doesn't demonstrate anything, but it illustrates that things should be rather difficult. And so if one uses a different arithmetic problem, then one can actually prove that this problem class is already NP-hard. Okay, and so what one needs to settle for then is some kind of approximation scheme. So when we optimize and optimizing is too hard, then we need to approximate. And so one can demand to get an approximation scheme like this. So here we're in the context of a maximization problem, and so I've put here somewhere a technical condition that this function should be non-negative over all the integer points. And then we can demand, for instance, that such an approximation should have a function value that is away from the optimal function value only by some epsilon factor times the optimal function value. That's one possible notion of approximation here. And we demand that we find an algorithm that computes an approximation that good for every epsilon greater than zero. And that should be a fast algorithm, fast not only in the usual data of the problem, but also in this parameter 1 over epsilon. Okay, so that's the strongest useful notion of approximation. And so, in fact, one can obtain such a thing, and so that's an old work with Jesus and other co-authors. And so that's what can be done using methods that are very close to what I present in the talk today. So that's using effective and efficient generating function methods. And so I'll show you some of the flavors of what we do, not all the details, but some of the flavors. And so that provides some motivation of looking at these things that we want to look at today. Questions so far? So usually these complexity things raise some questions. So here's the method that we'd like to call the summation method for optimization. And this takes the rather naive point of view that optimization is really just the limit case of doing something else, and that would be power p integration or summation. Okay, so that's kind of the thing. This is what people learn in our first analysis classes, and this seems to capture all of what optimization needs to do, right? So really, the field of optimization is really we just need to do this. Okay, so that's a naive point of view that we take here, and so of course that's just a qualitative statement. And so if one works this limit relation out using hard estimates, using Hilbert inequality, and so on in the suitable function space, then one can actually get complexity results for this that reduce the problem of optimization, in fact, to some concrete computational problems. And these are summation problems or integration problems. So in the purely discrete case, it would mean we are given a polytope, a P in Rn, and some polynomial G in suitable a number of variables. Then we want to compute such an integral, compute the sum of the g of x for x on all the lattice points. Okay, so the idea is really here in the discrete case, consider the bounded case. There are finitely many points. So when I said function space, it's really just an Rn for n very large. I'm just listing all the values of all the feasible points, coordinate by coordinate. And then I can use a version of Hilbert's inequality to tell me what kind of p do I need to get a certain approximation ratio. Okay, so that's the problem of exact summation that I need to solve in order to do this. And if I really want to do things like this also for continuous optimization, then I need to move over to integrals. So here we would need to look at continuous functions on the feasible region, and then that's a suitable function space, and there I need to solve computation problems like this. Okay, so and this actually works. So that's a way how one can obtain these fully polynomial time approximation schemes. One just needs to solve these kinds of computational problems. Okay, so that's I guess what we need to do. And now we want to be interested in some variants of this that lie in between. So if we want to do the same technique for mixed integer optimization, then we should be studying something that might look like this. Some integral over something of some densities like this. Okay, I'll make this more concrete later. So that's the motivation. If we want to do the same technology for mixed integer optimization, rather be studying sums, so mixed or intermediate sums like this. Okay, so and here's just some illustration that tells us how we can obtain such solutions to those computational problems. And so this hints at these ideas of using generating function approaches. So here's what we can do to evaluate such sums of polynomial densities. So consider this function here. This is just a discrete generating function GP of Z of some discrete interval here, so 0 to 4. So what's going on is, of course, that we're taking this, let's say, formal variable Z, and we are collecting these monomial terms Z to the power of 0 all the way to Z to the power of 4. And then we can use a common trick, and that's the use of the Euler differential operator. And the Euler differential operator ZdZ has a property, well, it pulls down the exponents and use them as coefficients. And if we do this suitable number of times, then we can evaluate monomial functions and put them here. Okay? And so you can imagine if I construct a suitable differential operator, then I can turn this generating function into one that is weighted by arbitrary polynomial densities here. Okay, and so if I finally, I didn't want to show this, if I finally evaluate this at z equals 1, well, if I did it up there, I would be counting integer points, so I would be counting 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 gives 5, but if I do it here, then I'm getting this weighted sum. Okay, so that's technology using generating functions. And so a computational trick is that one actually does not do this on these polynomials, but one actually observes that this is a finite geometric series. And so we can write it down using summation formulas and do the same thing symbolically on these rational functions. And then I can still evaluate this thing at z equals 1. I need to be a bit careful because there are some poles here, but this can be done. Okay, so this is all very easy in dimension one, but in higher dimension one needs to find a way to actually achieve such a representation of the generating function as a rational function. And so this is a computational problem that Barvinok solved in 1994, so this is very well understood now. And whenever the dimension is fixed, we can always write down such a generating function of the integer points in polyhedra in a form that always looks somehow like this simple formula on the top. Oh, I have an extended pointer here. Okay, very good. So so that's a general idea what generating functions do. And so here's just a quick recap what we would do for this case of polynomial optimization, polynomial integer optimization, right? So we're looking at this maximization problem. This is really just the limit identity. So now we can make this summation problem here more concrete by saying I'm just taking this pth power of my objective function, and I turn this into a suitable differential operator. I run this on the generating function. I evaluate this to actually add up. Then I guess I need to take some pth root here. Okay, and so by doing quantitative analysis of this, one actually gets to an FP task, an approximation scheme. Okay, and so this is kind of snapshots of what we knew about other cases. So around 2008, when we started working on the things that I actually am going to talk about today. So that's a continuous case. So it starts in the same way, but then we didn't really know how to best compute these integrals. Turns out integrals seem to be something really easy, and in fact they are easier than computing these discrete sums, but they're not so easy as one would imagine, because dimension can be high, and then things are a little bit harder than in Calculus 101. And so Jesus is going to explain some of these details in his talk on Friday. So, and here's the mixed integer case. Okay, so that's captured our understanding. So so let's move over to a different motivation that comes from the purer side of mathematics. So we want to study counting problems. So in particular, counting problems for some thin families of polytopes. And so a favorite thing that people do is to study rational polytopes, or in restricted settings, lattice polytopes, where all the vertices are actually integer points, and then to study families of these polytopes that are indexed by such an integer dilation factor. So we are just blowing up these polytopes. They're larger than, and then we can study how many lattice points do we have in such a polytope after dilation. And so that gives me a function that's known as the Erhard function, and that's what we want to compute. So one way to represent this Erhard function is as its generating function. So it would be the ordinary generating function where these values ip of n appear as the coefficients. And it turns out that's what's called Erhard theory. This function, if we have a lattice polytope, is actually a polynomial in n, so in the dilation n. And so if it is not a lattice polytope, then it's slightly more complicated, but still behaves in some polynomial way. So this is what's called a quasi-polynomial. So it's like a polynomial, but the coefficients are not constants, but they're rather periodic functions. So there's some of the arithmetic of the lattice points is captured then that goes on in this dilation. So and people, for various reasons, most prominently just from pure mathematics, are interested in computing such things. So so that's what we can set out to do. So we can try to compute the exact counting function in some format, either if it's possible as a polynomial or as a series, or maybe in some way as a quasi-polynomial. But sometimes this just turns out to be too hard, and so I'll comment on the complexity in a bit. So we might just want to look at the asymptotics of this function. And so in the easiest case, we're just looking at, if it's a polynomial, we're looking at the highest degree coefficient. And so that's something not so interesting, or maybe it is interesting, it's just the volume. So computing the volume is also nice. Some people like to compute volumes, but we can ask for more. We can ask for more asymptotics here. We can ask for the next highest coefficient, and then the next highest, and so on. So we can, for instance, ask for the top k coefficients of this polynomial or quasi polynomial, and so on. Right. So that's something that we could do, or we could leave this area of actually counting functions and look at weighted versions again. So that would mean now we're again considering some, let's say, polynomial density function h, and now we are looking at this function that sends n to the sum over these x in dilation n times p intersect c to the d of h of x. And so there are very good motivations for this, and so I understand in Ache's talk on Thursday there will be some explanation why this is interesting, so this is motivated by symmetry techniques. So that's some motivation for looking at the things that we do. So what's going on now? Complexity results. So everything is hard. One needs to fix certain things or consider thinner classes of things to make things polynomial time. And so if we have a polytope and just want to know is there a lattice point or not, then that can be done by a Lenz-Haas algorithm, so branching on hyperplanes. So if the dimension is fixed, if you want to count exactly, that's what Barvinok's algorithm 1994 does. Same thing also deals with Erhard polynomials of integer polytopes. again, everything fixed dimension. And so this was a breakthrough that in the first time dealt efficiently with a certain class of polytopes where we don't have the dimension fixed. So but we have to restrict ourselves to a rather easy polytope. So we can, for instance, do rational simplices, and then one can compute the top k, so the highest k, when k is fixed, coefficients of such a quasi-polynomial. So that was Barvinok's result from around 2005. So the techniques that we are looking at are very closely related to this paper here. So Barvinok did a particular construction using interpolation techniques and certain approximations that solved the problem. But they were not very canonical in the sense that there is no generating function level. So everything was done on the level of numbers and interpolation of certain numbers. And so what we are doing in this work is to find a generating function version that simplifies this work significantly and also deals with the weighted case and some other advantages. So let's take a look. So here's a review of some of the key properties of a generating function. So this is again the purely discrete case, and so I'll motivate this here to introduce more complicated properties of a mixed integer or intermediate generating functions. So one is what is captured in the so-called Hrovansky-Puchlikov-Lorentz theorem. So that tells us if we are looking at the linear map that sends the indicator functions of polyhedra to the generating function of the polyhedron, and we see this generating function as in this case a rational function of d variables, then this is actually a valuation. So this is really a linear map. So it's a linear map that agrees with this kind of sum whenever we know what the sum means. So a sum a and p, z to the a, this is for polytopes a finite sum, but for instance for cones, this is an infinite sum. So we need to use convergence to make sense of it. And so whenever we can make sense of it, so for instance for pointed polyhedra, then this agrees with this kind of result of the valuation. And it turns out that one always needs to assign a value 0 to non-pointed polyhedra, right? And then there are some beautiful properties that essentially come out of this property that on non-pointed polyhedra we have a contribution of 0, because then we can use some well-known decomposition techniques for polyhedra that go by the name Gram-Briançon. And so if one applies Gram-Briançon to any polytope sees that all non-pointed contributions need to be taken to zero, then one gets a very, very simple formula that tells us that the generating function is really obtained by just summing up the contributions at the vertices. Okay, and so that's what this picture captures. So take this polytope, then we really just need to get hold of the vertices and the corresponding tangent cones and contribute whatever is the local contribution there. And so that's a direct consequence of Gram-Briançon decomposition. And here's the same picture in 1D. So this is again our discrete interval here. And if we're looking at the tangent cones, that's really that half line here. And the other tangent cone would be that half line. And then the theorem says that if we're taking the sum of the two, then we're getting the generating function of this. So one sees here there's some interesting cancellation going on. That's precisely what's reflected by this idea that if you take a non-pointed polyhedron, for instance, this entire line, then you get a contribution of 0. Right? That's why so the formula looks wrong, for instance, here. Right? But this is all something that's vanishing in the kernel of this map. Okay. So what else? That's the evaluation property. That means that we can decompose. And if you want to make things into an algorithm, then we really need to get hold of certain generating functions explicitly. And so here's a way to look at a simple base case. So the base case for polyhedra is the case of affine simplicial cones. So these would be cones generated by just the right number of rays, and then attached to a certain vertex. Okay, and so for those we can explicitly write down the generating function. It's essentially just a product of geometric series, And then there are some explicit contributions that correspond to the lattice points in this fundamental cell. Okay, so and so one sees there's some trouble here. So if this fundamental cell is somehow large, then one has efficiency problems. And so this is exactly what Barabanov's algorithm actually addresses. And so one needs to be careful to actually turn things into an efficient algorithm. Okay, so so that's a discrete case. But there's something similar that we also have for the continuous case. So for the continuous case, we can also look at what we might be calling continuous generating functions. And so there's some beginning of this theory in this famous paper by Briand that looks at such exponential integrals. And so for exponential integrals, we also get some really nice formulas here. So exponential integrals, so exponential to some linear form, for instance, on the simplex, can be expressed using something that looks like this. And turns out that these expressions are just what we should view as the value of these exponential integrals on these unbounded cones at the vertices. Okay, and so what can be done with these exponential integrals is that we can basically extract whatever you want to know about any analytic function, or for that matter, any polynomial from this, because we can just expand stuff into Taylor series. And for instance, we can get powers of linear forms directly. And from these powers of linear forms, we can assemble by means of effective versions of the polynomial varying problem whatever we want to do, for instance, for polynomials. So let me skip this. I believe Jesus is going to talk about this to some length on Friday. So that's kind of the flavor for discrete and continuous that we can build upon. And so now let me show you something about the special difficulties in the mixed integer case. So let's return to the idea of doing optimization of certain functions over mixed integer problems. And so here's a typical problem. Well, no, it's a toy problem, actually. It's just two variables, one continuous variable, one integer variable. And so you see the feasible region here are just these blue lines. Well, they are not exactly lines, but on the top there's some degeneration. So one of the lines degenerates into a point, and that's what is causing trouble. So now imagine we want to use this kind of limit identity. So limit of the p norm is going to the max norm. And it turns out that this max norm actually is not the max norm. It's just the essential supremum. And so this essential supremum would forget about the contributions on the very top, because there's a kind of a measure zero situation. And so that creates some difficulty. And so what we need to do is to first take care that our approximation scheme cannot be fooled by such degenerations. And so there are several ways to deal with this. So one particular way works when we're in a particular polyhedral setup where somehow our polyhedron is rather close to a simplex, so where we don't have too many extra vertices compared to the dimension, where we have special objective functions that can be written in this form. So on the continuous variables, I cannot afford to use the full information on all the continuous variables, but I first need to project things into fixed dimension space. So now I have a function that only depends on a fixed number of variables, but I'm still in a situation where I have a fixed number of integer variables, but a varying number of continuous variables, and still such a complexity result, still such a fully polynomial time approximation scheme can be proved. So earlier, in this older work, we had a method that actually went back all the way to the discrete case using discretization on all the continuous variables, And so that's, of course, what optimizers don't like. Continuous variables are good, discrete variables are evil, right? And already that method had difficulties with such degeneration, so one needed to be very careful in the discretization. And in particular, using discretization, one cannot deal with these varying dimension cases. So the solution that we have now is a better solution that works also with some limited varying dimension cases. Okay, so so that's our motivation to look at mixed integer summation. And so let me probably skip this. So that's an explanation how we deal with these generations. So what we need to do is we somehow need to bring what we know about the continuous case and the discrete case into one framework. And so what's convenient is to make a change of variables here. So when we were looking at these discrete generating functions, we rather make a change of variables z equals, so each variable z1 would be replaced by e to the y1. So y1 is some fresh complex variable. And if we do this, then instead of looking at sums like this, we are now getting exponential sums like this. And so these look very, very much like the setting in these continuous generating functions. And so another way to view these things is that this is really a Laplace transform, right? So we have these new variables y here that live in the dual space. This is really the Laplace transform of the indicator function of the polytope with respect to a certain mixed measure that's like Lebesgue in one direction and counting in another direction. Okay, so when we do this, then we have the framework that we need, and now we can study these intermediate sums. And this is what they look like. So we don't need to read the theorem, but this is what they look like. So we are taking such a polyhedron, and what is prescribed is a certain linear subspace, L, and the linear subspace is the one over which we wish to integrate. And transversally to this, we need to sum somehow. So this is what's going on here. So if y is somehow a vector that addresses a slice of these mixed integer sets, then we are taking this slice p intersect y plus this linear space, and this is what we want to integrate over. So we are taking these exponentials here, e to the xi times x, so xi is again living in the dual space, and we want to integrate over appropriate measure, and so that should be a suitably scaled Lebesgue measure on that linear space and its parallel copies. Then we are taking these things, so these are the contributions of the individual slices, and we need to sum over all the slices somehow. And so the right notion here is really the projected lattice in this quotient space V mod L. Right, so this is precisely what is addressing these slices. So if I go back to the picture, right? So we imagine that this vector y somehow picks out a representative in these slices, for instance, this point, but it doesn't matter whether it lies here or whether it lies here, right? So it really lies in the quotient space V mod L. So V is the entire ambient space. So these are the sums that we want to study. Right, and so when we have these sums, so intermediate sums and integrals, then we can build up again such a valuation theory on top of this. So we can formulate such a version of this Chovansky-Puchlikov theorem, and so that's exactly the same as before. So we have these key properties. First of all, whenever this expression actually makes sense. So again, we need to be concerned about a convergence of the integrals and these sums. So whenever it makes sense classically, then we just take it as a value. On all other values of xi, we're actually just using the meromorphic extension. So these are special meromorphic functions that we attach to each polyhedron. And so this is what we call SL of p. And then we have to have these nice properties. So we have a nice translation property that's very important. So whenever we take a vector that lies in the lattice plus that linear space, so anything that is a difference vector between such slices, then if we look at the translation of P by this vector, then we can actually pull out a certain factor, and that's just the exponential. So that's a really easy manipulation. And that helps proving that whenever, again, we have a line in our polytope, so when it's not pointed, then the contribution is again zero. Okay. So that's this intermediate summation version of this generating function theorem. And again, to make things effective, to get an actual algorithm, we need to study certain base cases where we can explicitly write down such generating functions. And turns out a convenient base case is the case of simplicial cones with an extra property, and that extra property is the case where one face of the cone is parallel to that prescribed subspace L. So that's an example. So it's one-dimensional subspace L, and so that face generated by the vector V2 is it's parallel to L, right? And so that's the other direction that's transversal to this. And so for those examples, we can explicitly write down this intermediate sum, well, semi-explicitly. So it breaks down into two factors, as one might expect. There's a discrete summation going on. So this is a summation that's going on in the quotient space, and it's relative to the projected lattice. And then there's an integral, so that's denoted by this capital I. These two contributions just need to be multiplied together. And we actually have a very easy formula for the integral. So integral for these things dependent on C are really just these basic rational functions. And then the rest is just scaling to the right value. So this is the contribution of the vertex. So then of course one needs to deal with this discrete sum, but this discrete sum is really something that can be done by Barvinok's algorithm efficiently. So let's talk about the computational efficiency. So the idea is really whenever this sum takes place in fixed dimension, then this should be efficient. So what we need to do is we need to consider cases where that space L has a fixed codimension, then we should be able to solve these things efficiently. So that's what we can do. So that's the base case. And so if you want to deal with general polyhedra, of course we can use our decomposition following Brillouin to the vertices using Gram-Briachon formulas. These vertex cones will not in general have the property that one of the faces is parallel to that prescribed subspace. So we need to consider another decomposition. And so for this, we can recycle a decomposition that was used in a purely proof technique way by Briand-Vergne. And that works like this. So whenever there's any cone in a prescribed subspace, I can always construct explicitly such little cones that have this property. And you don't need to read the details. Actually, I've made them deliberately so small that you can't read this, unless you have really good eyes. So this tells us this construction here, and so this again tells us that the indicator function, the characteristic function of that cone, is the same as so these are certain plus minus signs times the indicator functions of these little cones that have the right property, and this is all modulo the space of functions of polyhedra with lines in them. So that's why you see so these yellow regions again don't match up. So because this needs to be a red modulo the right modulo the right half plane, right? So that's why we have this congruence here. So this is not an exact identity. Well, it's good enough for us simply because these contributions of non-pointer things don't matter. And again, if we look at what needs to be done, so this is a summation over over a complementary basis of that linear space that can be taken from the set of generators. And so this works out nicely. So when the codimension L is again fixed, then there are only polynomially many of these bases, and it's trivial to enumerate them. And I should not say it's trivial to enumerate them because I asked David to help me enumerate them. But we can easily prove that it's done in polynomial time. So that's what we can use, and so we can capture this kind of knowledge into a theorem that talks about a short formula for these meromorphic functions. And so you don't need to read the details. There's just details on how the input should be encoded. But the idea is that we output certain terms that look like this, and this gives you an idea what these generating functions look like. So this term looks complicated, but it's just an analytic function. So this is related to Bernoulli polynomials, and that's just an exponential. And then everything meromorphic about these meromorphic functions is really, really hidden in these rational terms here. So these are meromorphic functions with really very, very, very easy poles. So we can explicitly write down formula of this shape, and that's what we like to call the short generating function for this. And now we can evaluate this formula to extract certain data. So for instance, we can compute these polynomial, we can compute these sums and integrals of polynomial densities by doing the same thing that I more or less explained for the pure integration case. We can break our polynomial so that it is a sum of powers of linear forms, and everything about powers of linear forms is found by using a Taylor expansion of these things. So we need to do, of course, they're poles, so we need to do some work with the residues there. But it's all easy by doing serious calculations in few variables. So that's one kind of information that we get out of these functions. So we can compute explicit numbers. Okay, but sometimes we really want to find these counting formulas in a more closed form. So for instance, we want to find these Erhard polynomials or Erhard quasi polynomials. So it's not enough to just evaluate these things at some number and then be done with it, but we really want a formula. And so here's an idea that there's an idea to actually do this. So let's consider just lattice polytopes. So that's something that actually fits on this slide. So if we have lattice points as vertices, then everything is quite easy. So we are considering a polytope P and its dilation n times P. And then we can see that we, I should probably really use this. If it works. Okay, so this exponential sum over the integer points in the dilation can be expressed in this way. So first using this Briand formula as a sum over the vertices and corresponding cones at the vertices. And then you see that this dilation n is only found in the location of the vertex. Everything else is constant, not dependent on n. Because everything is so friendly, because vertices are lattice points, the dilation is an integer, I can actually pull out this factor of n times, this translation by n times s. I just explained there's this translation formula, and so this gives me this exponential term. And so the rest, so these s terms, these are just independent of n, they only depend on the cones. And then what we can use is an idea about these meromorphic functions. So I explained that these are very special. In fact, we always find a decomposition into homogeneous components, so that we can really attach a degree in terms of Xi to these things, and so we get such a kind of expansion here. And so this variable T that I introduced here actually helps us take out these homogeneous components, and turns out this one here, that should actually be the degree negative d contribution. This turns out to be just the integral. All the rest of these things are the sums and the corresponding homogeneous component of it, and so we can use such a decomposition. And then it's just a matter of putting together these series, and we get in the end some explicit formula for this expression, which ought to be, according to the theory, a polynomial, and we actually see that it is. So we actually see explicitly what are the coefficients of n to some power. And so here's a typical term. So n to the m plus d minus 1, its coefficient is this. So the only thing that we need to do is somehow get effectively hold of these homogeneous components of these meromorphic functions. And so that's what we can do algorithmically. So this is how one sees, first of all, how to extract such information about Erhard polynomials from these generating functions. But there's something, so I wouldn't have put this up if that was the only point, so that's a little bit too tedious. But that's a key point here, in that if I am interested only in the top coefficients, so the highest asymptotics of this, then I only need certain components of these generating functions of certain degrees. So turns out this one is, as I said, the negative d degree term of the generating function. This is the negative d plus 1 degree term, and so on. So if I want the top three, I only need the bottom three terms of the generating function. And that's the key to the following result. That is an approximation result that allows us to compute only the information that I want to. So if I decide I only want the highest terms, I only need to get algorithmic hold of the lowest degree terms of my generating function. And so now there's an idea that goes back to this Babinock 2004 paper that replaces our generating functions by certain approximations that are simply true for all the terms of Xi degree that we care about. But for terms of Xi degree that is too large, so greater or equal than this expression, we get some nonsense, but we don't care because we don't extract information from it. And so the idea here is to use a patching function. So there's also a beautiful geometric interpretation of it, but it's easiest to just introduce it like this. So we want a function that has the property that if I take any analytic function, or let's say a formal power series in one variable, then if I take a product of such functions, so using d terms, then I can actually write it as a sum of smaller such products if I'm only interested in terms of certain degree. So there's a certain way to patch together using such a function lambda of I. So this I runs to all the subsets of 1 to d of cardinality, at least d naught. So I can patch together these functions so that I can still extract all the terms of degree greater or equal than that expression. And so if I do this, and so there's a very easy way to obtain such a patching function. So this patching function exists and is independent of the function that I want to patch. Then I can apply this to this generating function and obtain what we call a lambda. So that's the approximation, and it is the same as what we want to compute, namely this generating function S of a cone in this case, except that it lies on all the terms that we don't care about. Okay? And so the trick is that what we get here is a sum of such intermediate generating functions, and these are behaved nicely in the sense that integration appears here on large subspaces, but summation only appears on small quotient spaces. So this is what can be done efficiently. So for instance, if we don't care about anything, if we really just want to compute the top asymptotic, so the volume or the integral, then so that appears as certain scaling as the top coefficient, then it turns out we don't need to use any discrete summation, and this is what one should expect, right? So that's precisely what this formula tells us. So then discrete summation dimension zero needs to be done. If we want to use one more term, then we need to do a summation in discrete summation in dimension one, and so on and so forth. Okay, so in this sense, this allows us to compute things where discrete summation would just not be feasible. And so here's an example that shows how this approximation works. So it's really, we are piecing together such a sum, so discrete sum, and so that's a corresponding generating function out of expressions that look like this. So this is again a discrete sum and continuous contribution, and so that's the other way around. And so one can check that the difference is actually an analytic function. So that is actually something that's not interesting. So one gets theorems of this type. So I promise that you don't want to read my theorems. But the point is that we can really express these Ehrhardt coefficients. So that's what I write here. So this is using certain modular expressions of n. So that's where this arithmetic part comes into play. So I can write them in some explicit form. So this is what we call a step polynomial. So these are polynomials. So this is all the coefficient of n to the m. And so these polynomials are polynomials in just modular expressions like this, and we can compute all of these data explicitly. So that's the way that we output these quasi-polynomials. So we get actual formulas that tell us how this counting or general weighted summation thing behaves. So we don't just get pointwise evaluations of this for particular dilations, closed formulas. So one can actually compute these things. So here's a preliminary implementation that we did in Maple. is now run on just a random lattice simplices in varying dimension, and just to see what it does, we compare here with different flavors of our old code Latte Macchiato that can solve such discrete such counting problems, so just the unweighted case, and so you see that independently of the flavor. If the dimension becomes too large, the runtime actually becomes prohibitively large. So we can't really do dimension 7 of this type of simplices in reasonable time. But if we restrict ourselves to compute less information, so if we just compute the top three Ehrhardt coefficients, then we can go much further. We can go into high dimension, and so the growth is very, very slow. So I should really say this is just a preliminary implementation. So we're working on a real implementation in the next version of Latte. And speaking of which, that's Latte. So we recently released a new version called Latte Integrale that actually deals with computing integrals as well. So Jesus is going to tell more about this. And so here are some references. Thank you very much.